So today I'm going to start to cover dark matter production. And this is this is kind of a fun topic because it combines all sorts of elements of physics that you've probably seen in different places and lumps them all together at once. So you have a bit of general relativity, a bit of elementary particle physics, a little bit of thermodynamics, and so on. And to compute dark matter production in the early universe involves a combination of all these things. Okay, so our typical dark matter candidate is some new stable neutral particle. And just based on what we know from observation, it might just interact through gravity. But typically, in our theories of elementary particles, these particles interact in ways that are stronger than gravity. So they're new interactions that are stronger than gravity. And one specific case that I mentioned before is a WIMP, where my stable neutral particle has weak interactions with other stuff. And you can generalize the idea of the WIMP to stable massive particles that have other weak-like interactions. And for the most part, I'm going to concentrate on this class of dark matter candidates. So WIMP or WIMP-like. And I'll say a little bit more about other classes of dark matter candidates later on. But in the case of WIMP-like particles, because they have interactions that are stronger than gravity, as long as the early universe was hot enough, we actually expect these WIMP particles to have been part of the thermal plasma. So in other words, we expect that at high temperatures, assuming the universe got at some point to a high enough temperature, so at sufficiently high temperature, the dark matter was part of the thermal plasma. And specifically, what I mean by dark matter being part of the thermal plasma is that the dark matter was in thermodynamic equilibrium with all the particles in the standard model. So thermodynamic equilibrium involves there are a couple of things that go along with this. I'm going to split what I call thermodynamic equilibrium into a chemical equilibrium. And a kinetic equilibrium. So what I mean by the chemical equilibrium is that the number density of the particle agrees with what I would expect from an equilibrium distribution. So in other words, if I'm looking at a species I, this means that the number density of the species I is equal to the equilibrium number density of that species I for the given thermal plasma, characterized by some temperature. The kinetic equilibrium, I'm separating this off from chemical equilibrium. And what I mean by kinetic equilibrium is that the velocity distribution is what you would expect from an equilibrated particle. So one example of, I need both chemical and kinetic equilibrium to have full thermodynamic equilibrium. But we're going to see that in the case of dark matter, the evolution of dark matter in the early universe, it's going to start off at equilibrium. And it's first going to fall out of chemical equilibrium, but it's going to stay in kinetic equilibrium. And the reason why the kinetic equilibrium lasts longer than the chemical equilibrium is there are more reactions contributing to the kinetic equilibrium than the chemical. So I'll try to make this more clear as I go along. But in any case, the thing that maintains equilibrium are particle collisions. So in the case of dark matter, I'm going to assume that my dark matter, I'm going to call it chi, is stable on account of some parity symmetry. And what I mean by this parity symmetry, I don't mean spatial parity, space-time parity, but some generalized parity. What I mean by this is that under the symmetry transformation, the dark matter state is odd, but any standard model particle is even. Yes?
Could you have the wind be unstable but have a really long lifetime due to some symmetry, and it could still work as dark matter?
So this has been looked at. I'll probably get to this a bit later in the course, okay. But it turns out that the lifetime you need for the particle to be dark matter is really, really long. So obviously the lifetime should be at least the length of the universe, the age of the universe. But typically, if your dark matter particle decays into stuff that's visible, you actually get much, much stronger limits from high energy cosmic rays from those dark matter decays. And there you get limits on the lifetime that are orders and orders of magnitude longer than the age of the universe. So, but getting back to this, for my dark matter particle, my dark matter is odd and all the standard model stuff is even. One example of this you may have seen in the BSM course is R parity and supersymmetry. In this case, the implication is that the dark matter can only be created or destroyed pairs. And if I apply this to think about the equilibrium of the dark matter particle, I have a class of interactions that contribute to the chemical equilibrium. So to determine the chemical equilibrium, you have processes that look like dark matter, goes back and forth with some number of standard model states. So that the forward or reverse reaction changes the number of the dark matter particles in the plasma. And since this process changes the number of dark matter particles in the plasma, this kind of reaction contributes to chemical equilibrium in the sense that the forward and reverse rates, assuming they're fast enough, are going to keep the number density of the dark matter particle equal to the equilibrium number density. So this kind of reaction contributes to chemical equilibrium. On the other hand, if I think about reactions contributing to kinetic equilibrium, well, these reactions will contribute to them to some extent, but the ones that tend to be really important are scatterings of dark matter with standard model particles in the plasma. So again, either the forward or the reverse reaction. So if I look at this process, I don't change the number of dark matter particles. So this kind of reaction doesn't contribute to the chemical equilibrium, but it does contribute to the kinetic equilibrium in the sense that suppose I start off with a standard model plasma, and suppose I stick some dark matter particles in the plasma that are initially at rest. So I take some dark matter particles, put them in the hot plasma, and the stuff in the hot plasma, because it's hot, is zigging around and it has some velocity distribution characterized by its temperature. This kind of reaction means that these high-energy standard model particles are going to scatter off the dark matter particles and impart some of their momentum to the dark matter. So if you wait long enough, as long as these reactions are fast enough, the dark matter particles are going to acquire the same temperature as a standard model. And you're going to reach a kinetic equilibrium. Now, what we're going to see is that this process, this kind of reaction, turns off before this sort of process. So what we're going to have for computing dark matter production, assuming the dark matter was initially in full thermodynamic equilibrium, is that we're going to track the turn off of this process, assuming that this one stays on. And the fact that this one stays on is a huge simplification. And I'll get to that in a minute.
Question?
Yes.
So what determines the Ni value that is going to be reached by the dark matter particles?
You mean in equilibrium or out of it?
Sorry, in equilibrium.
So I'll give that to you in a minute. But the short answer is the equilibrium value is it's just regular thermodynamics. I start with the Bose-Einstein or Fermi distribution, and I assume that the universe is equilibrium sister characteristic,
yeah,
and that gives me the equilibrium.
Yeah.
So this is the thermodynamics part. In fact, that's this is actually what I was about to write down. So, if you recall, if I have some system in thermodynamic equilibrium, I have some set of equilibrium distribution functions, and in the case you're probably most familiar with, these distribution functions are just Bose-Einstein or Fermi-Dirac. So this is just 1 over it's just this. Now, if you're not used to it already, I'm using units where h bar equals c and kb are all equal to unity. So everything has dimension of mass, or equivalently energy. So my equilibrium distribution is this. And in many cases of interest, this just reduces to the regular Boltzmann distribution. And we're going to be interested in relativistic particles. So our energy is basically just p squared plus m squared. So now, if I take these distributions and I apply them to relativistic particles, what I find for the equilibrium number density of some species I, and this is universal. Well, I get some general complicated expression, but it has simple forms in the high mass or low mass limits. So in the high mass limit, I get for the number density, For the number density, my number density just goes as temperature cubed. And these this initial factor of either 1 3/4 applies to bosons or fermions. And the numerical difference just comes about from the plus or minus 1 here. So this is the number density of a species I in thermodynamic equilibrium in a hot plasma, in the limit that the temperature is very, very, very high. And then in the opposite limit, where the temperature is low, good question. G is number of internal degrees of freedom. So things like spins or colors. I forgot to define that, yes.
But then you're, so that's just, you know, if we were talking about gluons, you could.
So if I was talking about gluons, I would have two polarizations and eight color states.
Right. But really, that's because you're talking about each type of it. It's only there because on the left-hand side, there's really like an implicit GI sort of.
In a sense, this is the total number density
right.
of all gluons.
Right, right.
Not the number density of gluons with color AB.
Right, okay.
Or quarks or what have you. But, yeah, but this is just the convention. So this is the high temperature limit. In the low temperature limit, what I find by integrating these distribution functions is just So in the low temperature limit, I find a familiar Boltzmann suppression. In the sense that if the temperature is small compared to the mass of the particle, then if the temperature is small compared to the mass of the particle, the energy of the particle is essentially just its mass, and I get a usual Boltzmann factor. And in terms of this kind of reaction, if I look at the chemical equilibrium reaction, what's going on is that if my particle is very massive, then I can go from the chi-chi to standard model direction, but I have a hard time going in the opposite direction because I have to live way out on the tail of the energy distribution. And that translates into a number density that's suppressed by Boltzmann factor. And I guess I probably should have put this on before, but recall that the relationship between the distribution function and the number density is, right. It's just that.
Could you just repeat what this one over three?
Sorry?
This 1 over 3 over 4.
What I mean by this is you put a 1 in here for bosons and a 3 quarters in here for fermions.
Okay, yeah.
It's just notation. I mean 1 or the other.
Okay.
It's not a 1 over. It's a choose 1 or the other depending on your.
Yeah.
Okay, so the point is that my number density, I take my distribution function, and I integrate it over the set of independent states, which in this case is characterized by just all the momentum states. And the 2 pi cubed is accounts for the phase space. I stick in a GI because, as you said, if I talk about a quark, I don't talk about just one color of quark. I talk about all colors of quarks in a system. And in general, I've written down the equilibrium value here. But more generally, this relation also applies away from equilibrium. So everything here is specifically in equilibrium, but we're going to be interested in departures from thermodynamic equilibrium. And it'll be the departures from thermodynamic equilibrium that are going to give us the leftover dark matter. So what's going to happen, in a sense, is that this will be the equilibrium distribution for a heavy dark matter particle at temperatures much below the dark matter mass. But the dark matter particle is going to fall out of equilibrium, and it's going to end up with a density that's much larger than its equilibrium value. And this leftover dark matter density is called the Rayleigh density. And this large leftover density is exactly what we need to make up the observed dark matter. OK, so far, everything has been in thermodynamic equilibrium. And just quickly, I can also define the energy density. And this is just I just convolve the distribution function with the energy. I can do the same thing with momenta or any other expectation value. All right. Okay, so we need to take our equilibrium thermodynamics, and we need to do two things to it. The first is we have to take into account that the universe is expanding. So instead of just having a static background, we have a background that's changing. It's changing relatively slowly, but it's still changing, and this is going to be important. The second thing we have to do is look at deviations of the distribution functions from equilibrium. So in general, if I have some system that's not necessarily in thermodynamic equilibrium, but I describe in some statistical sense, I can still write a distribution function f that's generally a function of x, p, and t. And I can write an equation for the evolution of this distribution function, and it compute its evolution. So the way this is usually set up is this is going to look very cryptic, and then, like I said, it is cryptic. The way this is usually written, and it's given the name of Boltzmann equation. Boltzmann equation. Is this. And what I mean by the left side is the left side is essentially a total time derivative, but you take its general relativistic generalization. So the classic setup is you take ddt plus v dot grad x plus dp dt grad p plus the whole thing. So in the classical picture we have this, but we want to generalize this to be general relativistically covariant. And the generalization of this piece, which, well, if you look at it, is just a total time derivative. The generalization of this, let me try to get this right, is p alpha ddx alpha gamma alpha beta gamma p beta p gamma alpha. Where this is the Christoffel symbol. I'm writing this down because this is going to come up in an expanding universe, and we're going to get a function, we're going to get a factor of the Hubble constant. But this side, at its heart, it's just a total time derivative. So this L is called the Liouville operator. On this side, this is the so-called collision term. And the collision term takes into account, well, it takes into account both kinds of collisions here. The ones that lead you to chemical equilibrium, the ones that lead you to kinetic equilibrium. But what's going on the right side is you take into account all the scattering reactions that drive your system towards thermodynamic equilibrium. Whether it's towards chemical equilibrium or kinetic equilibrium, you account for all of that on that piece. So at this stage, everything looks cryptic, but at its heart, this is just a very dumb equation. It's just saying that the rate of change in my distribution function is equal to the rate of all the reactions that are going on, and up to some general relativistic corrections. So there's nothing too special here. And we're going to specialize this fairly complicated thing to a Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe. And in this case, we can simplify our life. So remember that starting off in the equilibrium system, assuming a background that's not changing at all, our distribution functions in equilibrium only depend on energy. We're not going to be in thermodynamic equilibrium. We're going to look at deviations from thermodynamic equilibrium. So our distribution functions are now going to pick up a dependence on temperature. But on the other hand, because we're assuming an FRW universe, we're implicitly assuming that everything is basically the same everywhere, so that there are no huge anisotropies. And this is what we see observationally. The cosmic microwave background is very, very uniform. So we can get away with ignoring, at this point, spatial variations. And the same way we can get away with ignoring specific momentum variations. And that means we can just look at the case where our distribution functions depend only on time and energy. So we can completely characterize the distribution of the system according to its energy and the time. The other thing is that, in general, these distribution functions will give you deviations from both, will describe deviations from both chemical and kinetic equilibrium. We're going to assume implicitly that kinetic equilibrium is maintained. And this is going to make our life a lot easier. But if we assume that the kinetic equilibrium is maintained, then the thing we really care about is the chemical equilibrium. And we can concentrate on specifically the number density of some species I at a given time, which is just going to be, again, as I just defined, a D3P or 2 pi cubed. GI times the corresponding distribution function. So this is the thing that we're going to track. And now, if I take my general Boltzmann equation, and I assume that my distribution function has that form, and I integrate both sides over the over D3P over the momentum of the particle, what I get out in an expanding universe is the following equation. So my Liouville operator turns into this when I integrate it. So here I have n dot, or equivalently dn dt. The Christoffel symbol has all the GR junk fit into it. And all this GR junk turns out in an FRW universe just to give me a factor of 3 times the Hubble constant. So H is just my usual A dot over A. And this piece, again, is it's my collision operator. But I'm going to put a tilde over it to take into account that I've taken both sides of this equation and I've integrated them. I've integrated them over D3P. So I still have to specify what this C tilde is, and I'll do that right now. So suppose I have suppose I have species I, any reaction that changes the number of species I, the number of the species I is going to contribute to this. And suppose I look at reactions of this form. So I have my I species plus some other stuff in some forward and reverse reaction with stuff that goes into final states A, blah, 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 to B. My modified collision operator in this case turns out to be, so this is going to, this will be a bit of a mess, but please bear with me. Sorry, I've labeled this wrong. It should be. Okay, let me just make sure I have all the factors. Okay, so this is the big ugly expression. But this is a big ugly expression with lots of parts, but it's actually not that complicated. And let me try to break down the parts into stuff that makes it's easier to understand. So these d pi's correspond to integrals over phase space. So specifically, d pi I for any species is just a d3 pi over 2 times the energy times 2 pi cubed. So it's just a phase-based integral, d3p over 2 pi cubed, with a factor of 1 over 2e. And I have one of these for every single initial state and every single final state. The next piece is just the usual four momentum conserving delta function. In other words, the four momentum of the whole system has to be conserved. Okay, these pieces correspond to relative rates for the forward or the reverse reaction. So this first piece, this m squared, so what I mean by m squared for I to f is the squared matrix element for the corresponding scattering process, just as you compute using your usual quantum field theory techniques. But there are two special things you have to do. The first is that you need to average this thing. So this is my squared matrix element, and I sum over all the initial spins and colors. I sum over all the final spins and colors, but I want to make those sums into averages, so I have to divide off by total color or spin factors. So what you're usually used to computing when you compute cross sections is you take the squared matrix element, you sum it over all final states, and you average it over all initial states. In this case, this quantity here is the same thing, except now I average over all initial and final states. Okay, maybe I'll try that. Okay, so these pieces just correspond to the matrix elements you compute, just the things that go into the cross sections, with the one twist that instead of summing over the final states, I average over them, which just means that I sum over them and then I divide off by the total number of final states. So these matrix elements should also be familiar. It's just a matrix element that you compute using quantum field theory or classical physics, depending on the situation. And finally, these distribution functions weight the matrix element. And what you can think of this as doing is this fx to blah, 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 fi corresponds to the distribution functions of the initial states. So okay, of course. So these are the initial state distribution functions. And the point is that if I have more if I have more distribution weight in initial state, then my forward reaction is more likely to happen than if I have, let's say, less weight in the final state. So this is the forward reaction, this is the reverse reaction, but I weight these matrix elements that correspond effectively to cross sections by the amount of distribution weight in the initial state. So these factors are the initial state weight that determine whether the forward or reverse reaction goes quickly. And finally, these pieces you can usually ignore. But these pieces correspond either to something called Fermi blocking. Or stimulated emission. So these factors, the plus is for bosons, the minus is for fermions. And the place where these factors come up is that suppose my final state has all kinds of fermions in it. So suppose my final state is dense with fermions, looks like some kind of Fermi C. Then that means that most of the states in that final state are going to be filled up. And as I start filling up the set of allowed final states, this distribution function with a minus sign is going to suppress the effective rate for that forward reaction. On the other hand, if my final states are bosons, bosons all like to get together and hang out, and the plus sign takes into account that effect. And that's called, so in the first case, I have Fermi blocking. And that I have a Fermi C that it's hard to find a place to put my final state into. On the other hand, the plus sign corresponds to bosons that like to condense and get together. So the point of this is I have this term for the so-called forward reaction. I have this term for the reverse reaction. And the matrix elements are for this forward reaction and reverse reaction are usually the same. And in a second, I'm going to argue that we should assume they are. But the only difference between the forward reaction and the reverse reaction is here I weight by the initial state phase space factors. Here I weight by the different initial state for the reverse reaction. And these other factors can be important in some cases, but for us, they're going to turn out not to be. And there's one last piece, which is this 1 over s, and that's the so-called symmetry factor. And the symmetry factor gives you a factor of 1 over n factorial So what I mean by the symmetry factor is that suppose I have n identical states in any initial state or in any final state, then I should put in a factor of 1 over n factorial to make sure I double count, I don't overcount the phase space. To account for the fact that quantum mechanically these states aren't distinguishable. Okay, so this is the collision operator. And it's a big mess, but even though it's a big mess, the stuff that goes into it is all very simple. And I hope it's at least somewhat intuitive. I look at matrix elements weighted by distribution functions for the forward and reverse reactions, and then I just integrate everything over phase space with a momentum conserving delta function. Okay, so far we've done things in full gory detail. I want to specialize now to the specific case of interest, which is dark matter annihilation in the early universe. So we're going to use these equations to compute the departure of dark matter density from thermodynamic equilibrium. So where am I? I'm going to do this for the specific case of the reaction where I have two dark matter particles going back and forth with pairs of standard model particles. So to be specific, I'm going to assume that the final state is a fermion antifermion pair for some standard model fermion. So the left side of my equation, if I look at the number density, the left side of my Boltzmann equation is just going to be n chi dot plus 3h n chi. So that's the simple part. The ugly part, the complicated part, is going to be the corresponding collision term. So this collision term, for this collision term, we can make some simplifications. The first simplification is that it's going to turn out that our distribution functions will be relatively small compared to unity. And because our distribution functions will be small compared to unity, it's going to be a good approximation to just to treat them as Boltzmann factors. So the relevant densities and energies and the situation of interest, we're not going to be the sensitivity on whether the particle is a boson or fermion in terms of its distribution is going to turn out not to be important. So this is going to make our lives easier for one. And similarly, we're going to drop we're going to drop the stimulated emission or probably blocking factors. Yes.
So what is the physical assumption behind assuming it's Maxwell Boltzmann? You said it's less than unity.
Did I erase my? Okay. So my Maxwell Boltzmann distributions are up top.
Right.
So for most cases of cold dark matter freezeout that we're interested in, it's going to turn out that the place where we start to care about the rates, we start to care about stuff, happens when the mass is roughly 20 times the temperature. So that means that this e to the e over t is going to be way larger than
right.
one. And that means that, and that corresponds to the distribution function being very small. Yeah, so it's something to worry about, but in this case, it turns out to be a good approximation. Okay, so that's the first thing. The other thing is that if I look at the matrix elements for the forward and reverse reactions, they're not always identical to each other. But for them not to be identical to each other, it turns out that you need CP violation. And we know that, CP violation can be very important in some cases, but it usually ends up being a small effect in terms of the difference between the matrix elements. So, for example, to change the matrix elements for the forward and reverse reactions, it turns out that you need an interference between the tree level diagram and loop diagrams. So the difference is, even if they are there, if there is CP violation, are typically numerically small. At least if the interactions are perturbatively weak. So I'm going to assume that both the forward and reverse matrix elements, averaged over initial and final states, are just equal to each other. And I'm just going to call this m squared. So that's my second simplification. And if I do that, and I apply everything above, what I get for my collision term, in this case, is going to be a minus d pi chi 1, d pi chi 2. But because I have two identical particles in the final state, I get a symmetry factor of 1 half. And then I'm going to have dpf, so dpf bar. I probably shouldn't use, my choice of f for fermion is a bit of bad notation. Try not to confuse fermion with distribution function. But in any case, this should be a pi. And I need my delta function, my 2 pi to the fourth del 4. And now going to the last bit, I can factor out my matrix element because I'm assuming that the both pieces are the same. And I'm just left with distribution functions. I'm left with f chi 1, f chi 2, minus ff, ff bar. Okay, so I can simplify this further by using the fact that the fact that I'm simplifying my distribution functions in equilibrium as Boltzmann factors, and that I also have energy momentum conservation. And my further assumption is that these standard model particles, these fermions, these FF bar, I'm going to assume are in complete thermodynamic equilibrium, which should also be a good approximation as long as my dark matter is heavy enough. So as long as this process is happening at a relatively high temperature, my standard model fermions, or at least some fraction of them, should be in thermodynamic equilibrium. So under those assumptions, I have for this factor, e to the minus ef over t, e to the minus e f bar over t, which if I apply momentum, or if I apply energy conservation, is equal to this factor. Yes?
So in the definition of n, the distribution function is not the thermal equilibrium distribution function, but when we are computing the right-hand side, we are using the thermal equilibrium distribution function.
Oh, sorry. Everything in here is just the general distribution function.
Right.
But I'm going to assume that these standard model states are in thermodynamic equilibrium. So the picture is I have a standard model plasma. The standard model plasma is fully in equilibrium, and I'm looking at departures of the dark matter particle from being in equilibrium with that plasma.
Okay.
So I assume that these pieces are equilibrium distributions. And that gives me this factor here. But because of energy conservation, EF plus EFR is equal to E chi 1, E chi 2, the two dark matter particles. And this piece is F chi 1, F chi 2 in equilibrium. So all that I mean by this is these are distribution functions that the dark matter particles chi 1 and chi 2 would have if they were in thermodynamic equilibrium. We're computing deviations from that. So in general, these distribution functions are not going to be equal to these distribution functions. But this does that does mean that this factor turns into f chi 1 f chi 2 minus f chi 1 equilibrium f chi 2 equilibrium. So at this stage, at this stage, you're starting to see how this collision term is describing departures from equilibrium. If f chi 1 and f chi 2 are equal to their equilibrium values, then this vanishes, and I have no collision term. And that means that this left side is going to be equal to this right side. And that means I would just get, if I was in thermodynamic equilibrium here, this piece vanishes, and this piece would be equal to 0. And you can check that if I just set this equal to 0, the solution is that my n chi is proportional to a to the minus 3. So remember that this n is a number density. So you can think of it as the total number of particles within a unit volume. But that unit volume is expanding, but the number of particles isn't changing. So that's why, from the expansion of the universe, my number density dilutes as a to the minus 3, assuming there are no reactions to change the total number of particles. OK. So at this point, I'm going to pull a bit of a fast one. It turns out to be well justified, but it's going to be a bit of a fast one in that I'm not really going to fully justify the thing I'm going to do, but I'm going to ask you to take it on faith. And the thing I'm going to ask you to take on faith, I guess it's fairly reasonable, but I just want to state explicitly what I'm doing. And the thing I want you to take on faith is that we're going to assume that our dark matter stays in kinetic equilibrium while this whole process happens. So we're primarily interested in deviations from the number density of chi from the equilibrium value. But we're going to assume that while those dynamics happen, the scattering processes, let's say elastic scattering processes with a standard model, maintain kinetic equilibrium. So we assume that chi is in kinetic equilibrium. And the implication of this is that my distribution function for chi, which is going to be some function of energy and temperature, factorizes into an overall scaling factor that depends on the time. And just the equilibrium value. So in other words, so overall scaling factor times the equilibrium value. So this isn't entirely crazy, in the sense that if I'm in kinetic equilibrium, my distribution of my relative distribution of energies should track what I would have in full thermodynamic equilibrium, but my number density doesn't have to match up. So the fact that I track the velocity distribution in the correct way, not the number density, is accounted for by that factor. So what this means with this assumption is that I can further simplify this collision term. I can further simplify this collision term by replacing these by this overall scaling times the equilibrium value. Yes?
Those T's, are they somehow related? Because at a given, like the temperature is changing with time, right?
Oh, sorry. The temperature is also, so yes, yeah, so this is time.
Right.
In the co-moving frame. This is temperature.
But that's changing as time.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So but I treat this as an adiabatic change.
Okay.
So yeah, you're right. Because the temperature is changing, the equilibrium distributions of the plasma change, but they change in a very slow way, in the sense that the rate of the universe expanding is really, really slow compared to the rate that the particles equilibrate.
But I thought the whole point was that eventually that rate isn't slow compared to the interaction rate. Eventually, the mean free path
Yeah, well, but as far as what we're computing here, the rate for kinetic equilibration is still very fast.
Okay, right.
So we're primarily interested in losing the chemical departures from chemical equilibrium, but it should be a very good approximation to maintain the kinetic equilibrium. Okay. So actually, even before this step, I could have done this right away. By rewriting this term in terms of these initial state distribution functions, I can take this factor and move it outside of these d pi f integrals. And what I get, so I'll come back to that in a minute, but what I get is I have integrals over the initial phase spaces. Chi 1, chi 2. I forgot a factor of 2 here. I get a factor of 2 here because the number of chi's I change in the reaction is 2. So in other words, every forward reaction destroys 2 chi's, and every reverse reaction produces 2 chi's. So I need a factor of 2 here that I forgot, but that 2 exactly cancels off with the symmetry factor. So I'll just drop the 2's for now. So I have this, and then I've got my final space, my integral over the final phase space. I shouldn't have written it here, but I'm going to erase this just to make room for it. Sorry about this. So here I have a 2 pi fourth. Del 4 m squared. So this last piece, I claim, should look familiar to you. Because this last piece is precisely the combination that you get when you compute cross-sections. So it's the piece that you get when you compute cross-sections minus a few factors. So the few factors that you're missing here turn out to be g1, g2 times, let me get my notes just to make sure I get all the factors right. Forget the g1, g2s. Up there. This piece turns out to be 2e1 times 2e2 times sigma v rel. So if you go back and you look at your notes from quantum field theory for the expression for a cross section, the cross section is just this piece divided by 2e1. Divided by 2e2, divided by 1 over v rel. So the final combination I get out of this is that.
What is sigma?
Sorry?
Sigma relative.
Oh, okay. Well, so the sigma is the cross section.
Yeah, sure.
And in the expression for the cross section, you have this funny velocity factor. It's not quite the relative velocity, it's actually a molar velocity, but there's this velocity factor in the expression for the cross section.
You're saying these two are equal.
I'm saying this, the sure. Square bracket, and in other words, this thing is equal to the square bracket.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll finish up in a second. But the point is that now I can take this. I can take this and compare with these factors, and the point is I have the sigma v times 2e1, 2e2. Those 2e1 and 2e2 cancel off the 1 over 2e1, 1 over 2e2 in these factors, and this just turns into a d3p, d3p2 with distribution functions times this combination sigma v. So it turns out that this whole right-hand side, and also applying this result, this right-hand side is equal to minus sigma v times n chi squared minus n chi equilibrium squared. And what I mean by the sigma v in brackets is I have I get this right. I have a 1 over n eq squared p through p1 2 pi cubed d3 p2 2 pi cubed f1 equilibrium f2 equilibrium sigma v. So in other words, I define my thermal average. These brackets refer to a thermal average as I take my momentum distributions. I take my phase space. I take my momentum distributions. I put in the operator I'm interested in, and then just integrate over all the phase space. And then I normalize by NEQ, so that the expectation value, the thermal average of the unit operator, is equal to 1. So this gives me my final Boltzmann equation for this process. I have n chi dot plus 3h n chi is equal to minus this thermally average cross section n chi squared n chi equilibrium squared. So very quickly, if we look at this in two limits, in the limit where this term is big compared to this term, then my n chi is driven to the equilibrium value. And it's driven to the equilibrium value exponentially quickly. So I'll call this term 1 and term 2. So if term 2 is much, much bigger than term 1, then I have n chi driven to n chi equilibrium. On the other hand, if t2 is much, much smaller than t1, then I just have this n chi proportional to the eta minus 3. So in the next class, we'll study the solution to this equation and the interpolation between these two limits. But the interpolation between these two limits corresponds to what's called thermal freeze-out. In that what we're going to see is that this term becomes increasingly less important than this term. So you start off at equilibrium with this term being dominant, but this term shuts off. You're only left with this term, and these reactions turn off, and your particle density just then dilutes away. Yeah.
So the distribution functions in the average are the F distribution functions, right? The F particles, tandem model particles.
These are the distribution functions for so remember sigma v doesn't depend on anything having to do with the final states. So sigma v is a function of the initial energies and momenta.
Right.
Here I'm integrating sigma v over these initial momenta. So I cheated on the notation by d3p1, I mean d3p chi 1. So, and similarly, these are the distribution functions for my chi's. Yes, I cheated on the notation there. Yeah. Oh, come in, sorry. Oh. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, where did?
C, what
if
that better is?
Oh no, it's just some scale. It's just some time dependent constant.
Right, but in that integration, it seems like when we did that acquisition, that thermal average, where is it hiding in the head?
Oh well, so because I have this factorization. What I should really do is do a thermal average with the distribution functions. So here I'm doing the thermal average with the equilibrium distribution.
Yeah.
I should really do it with the full thing. But the thing is, if I do it with the full thing, I can factor out those psi factors.
Yeah.
And do it with the equilibrium thing,
yeah.
And then put those psi factors into.
So the timing in the end.
Yes, exactly.